Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Thank you and welcome everybody. We are glad to have you today. Just a few reminders. You are not to photograph or videotape or audio tape this proceeding. Please recall that you should mute yourself when you are not talking, but unmute yourself when you are talking. And please, when you reference facts in the case, we would appreciate record cites. And please recall that rebuttal is for rebuttal only. And with that, we will begin case number 20-30240, Miller versus Reliance Standard Life Insurance Company. And we'll begin with Mr. Toledano for Michael Miller.
Good afternoon. This is Reagan Toledano on behalf of the appellant, Michael Miller. The main issue in this case is whether the pre-existing condition clause applies to Michael Miller. And we believe it clearly does not for several reasons. The most important reason is this policy had a transfer of insurance coverage provision whereby Mr. Miller was to receive credit for the previous time he's been insured under the plan. He has been insured under this plan ever since Lake Charles Pilots ever began a long-term disability plan for the group. He was the president for many years. He's always been insured. And in 2015, he had to take disability leave. And during that leave of absence, Lake Charles Pilots decided to switch insurers. And Reliance Standard began insuring the plan on September 1st, 2015. Which was at a time that Mr. Miller was out on disability leave to a different carrier at the time. It was Prudential. He eventually returned to work and became disabled again. And the issue became whether the pre-existing condition clause applies. The policy has a transfer of insurance coverage provision that's set, and there are several requirements of that. But one of the requirements and the one that's at issue today is whether he was an active full-time employee on the day that Reliance began insuring the plan.
Mr. Toledano, I was not an insurance attorney, so I need to be spoon-fed this. I need you to hold my hand and walk me carefully through this because I get lost. As I understand, you're saying whether he was active is the key part, because if he's not active, then he's not an eligible person with respect to the transfer provision. Am I following?
That's correct. The requirement is that he needs to be an active full-time employee on the date of the transfer.
Okay.
That's right.
And just one other question, just sort of preliminary question. We're not talking about whether he was actively at work, which is a defined term, right? Because as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, the parties agree that he wasn't, quote, actively at work, such that the first paragraph of the transfer provision would sort of take care of this. Is that right?
That's right. That's undisputed. He was not actively at work, but he was an active full-time employee. And the Sixth Circuit in Wallace decided literally this exact issue. It was the exact same policy language. It was the exact same factual circumstances. A claimant there was out of work on disability leave, just like Michael Miller, and Reliance denied the claim. And they said that she was not an active full-time employee because she was not actively at work. Actively at work, as noted by the Sixth Circuit, is a term of art defined in the plan, and it has certain meaning. But the eligible employee section of the policy does not require being actively at work. It just requires that the person be an active full-time employee. And the Sixth Circuit concluded that that could include someone who's not retired, someone who's still an employee of the plan, but just happens to not be at work that day when the insurance took effect.
Well, I assume from that definition that active has to have a meaning independent of full-time, right? You have to be both an active employee and a full-time employee.
That's right.
Okay, so help me with, I get that active is different from the defined term actively at work. I get that. Help me with how should I think about active in that, because it's not defined in the policy. So what does it mean? to be an active full-time employee?
Well, one example that comes to mind is think about someone who's in the military. They're actively serving for the military, but they might not be at work on a certain day because it's a weekend or they're on sick leave. But they're still active employees. As long as they're not terminated employees or they haven't retired, they are active. And that is what the Sixth Circuit found. And the Sixth Circuit said, at the very least, it's ambiguous. Because, you know, if they really wanted there to be an actively at work requirement, they should have said so clearly in the policy, and they didn't. They just say active full-time employee. And
well, they kind of actually said the opposite. I mean, that second paragraph is expressly for somebody who wasn't actively at work due to injury or sickness. Right?
That's right.
Okay, so it seems like you have the actively at work, paragraph one, and paragraph two is somebody else, because if you're actively at work in paragraph one, you would need paragraph two.
Right.
Paragraph two says that blah, 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 but not actively at work due to injury or sickness and would otherwise qualify as an eligible person. So to me, it seems like active has to mean something other than me sitting in this chair right now where I'm actively at work.
Right.
Yeah, it means, I believe what it means is what the Sixth Circuit found it to mean, and what also this court decided it meant in the Jackson case, which was an unpublished decision, but it was very similar to the reasoning that the Sixth Circuit employed. But I believe it meant that you're still an employee, you're just out at the time, and you can be, as long as you're not retired or you haven't been laid off, you are still an active employee. You're just not there at that moment because you're out on sick leave or you're for some other reason. Maybe it's the weekend, or maybe it's a holiday, the day that the insurance took effect. But I think at best it's ambiguous. And under an ambiguity, under the Fifth Circuit jurisprudence, he should win. He shouldn't have to face a pre-existing condition exclusion whatsoever.
Please go ahead if you want to say more about active.
I don't know what else to add to that other than it doesn't mean actively at work.
Remind me, did the district court really address this idea of active and eligible person in the transfer? Did the district court focus more on the payment of premiums?
The district court did. I believe that the district court did find that that he was not actively at work. So the court read into a requirement that he had to be actively at work. The court essentially bought Reliance's argument at the district court level, which was contrary to the Sixth Circuit's decision.
Okay, so there's that issue. And then the district court did find that premiums had not been paid. I'm probably getting the language wrong.
That's correct. The district court made a ruling that the premiums were not paid, which to this day, I don't understand why. First of all, that issue should not have been taken up by the court at all because Reliance failed to assert it during the administrative process. And the essence of an ERISA case is a review of an administrative record where Reliance explains all of its arguments, we get to rebut them, and then we're sitting at the district court level almost in an appellate capacity. And here we never got that because Reliance for the very first time alleged that the premiums weren't paid while we were briefing the motions for summary judgment. And it simply was untrue. The reason why they never argued this at the district court level is because it was untrue. Reliance knew all along that the premiums were paid. They had the information showing that the premiums were paid. So as soon as they made that argument, which I don't believe the court should have allowed them to make it after the fact, but assuming that the court allowed it, we moved to supplement the administrative record with a declaration from the insurance agent showing that the premiums were in fact paid. And we also provided a detailed invoice a paid invoice that demonstrates that Michael Miller's specific premium amount was included in that amount and they received the full amount of that payment. I don't know what else we could have possibly, we could all have submitted more, but that was the best evidence we could show that the premiums were paid. And somehow the court said they weren't. The only thing I can think of is the court got a little bit mixed up because Reliance had stated in its brief that the premiums were not paid. Maybe the court took them at their word on that.
And what's weird to me about that is that's something that is clearly within Reliance's knowledge to ascertain. It's not something they can only get from you, like what is your Social Security number or something like that. They know they were paid the premium. So I'm just confused a little bit by the whole, I guess they're just arguing you had a burden of proof at the administrative proceeding and you didn't meet it, but they didn't say that. So I don't know. I find it a confusing argument by Reliance.
You and me both. Absolutely. Yeah. And the Sixth Circuit was a little bit perplexed by it as well. And they noted in their opinion that Reliance is the one that knows whether the premiums were paid. And I mean, they approved two different short-term disability claims for Mr. Miller. And had he not paid his premiums, that would have been the first thing they would have said. They would have said, you had no coverage here. And we wouldn't even been arguing about anything about the pre-existing condition because he either would have had coverage or not. And we, in our appeal, we argued that the premiums were not paid and there was just no reason to provide any other information because Reliance had all the information. You know, the information ultimately that we gave to the court that showed that the premiums were paid were on Reliance's letterhead. I mean, it was basically the paid invoice that Reliance had in its own possession. And Reliance could have simply, I mean, asked its, or the Reliance's attorney could have simply asked its client, were the premiums paid while we were litigating this issue? But it was just, I don't know, but.
Well, I guess we'll see if Reliance is going to continue to press that argument when they argue. Can I ask you sort of about an order of decisions? Let's assume the panel agrees with you that the transfer provision applies. Do we need to reach the other issues in the case? And I'm thinking specifically about whether the right knee disability is an excluded pre-existing condition, and then about whether the neck and back disabilities are substantiated by the record.
If the transfer of insurance coverage provision applies, then there's no need to get into whether the back or the knee were pre-existing conditions because the pre-existing condition clause does not apply whatsoever. It's not an issue. And that's, I mean, these policies are designed this way. They're designed to credit periods that claimants have been insured under the plan before they become insured. And that's exactly what this policy did. And it just so happened that Mr. Miller was out on disability leave on the day that Reliance began insuring the plan, but we believe he still has coverage. His coverage should transfer. It's just, and here's a guy that paid these premiums for years and years and years. He was the guy that started the group disability plan. I mean, this was
the Sixth Circuit, I believe it remanded for further proceedings, maybe some fact finding. If we agreed with you, do we need to remand?
I don't believe so, because the reason why the Sixth Circuit remanded was because the district court never looked into whether he was a full-time employee. So that was an issue in that case. In our case, in the Miller case, there's no issue of whether he was full-time or not. When he was working full-time. There's no partial part-time employment for a bar pilot. There was evidence in the record, which we cited into a brief that showed that his schedule was basically, I think it was 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off or some sort of schedule like that. But it was full-time employment. He was working a minimum of 30 hours a week when he was working. That's demonstrated in the pay stubs that are provided. We cited it into our brief. So there's no reason to remand at this point. He was an active full-time employee at the date that Reliance began insuring the plan. He's entitled to his credit for his time towards the pre-existing condition limitation that he had already developed.
Let me ask you this on the premium issue. Is the fact that they did pay the short-term disability some evidence that the premiums have been paid? You know, your point earlier that insurance companies, I have a lot of experience with insurance companies, and it appears to me that typically they don't offer coverage when you haven't paid your premiums. So would that be some evidence of that, the fact that they had paid those short-term disability, would that be some evidence that they did in fact get paid a premium?
Yes, it would, because that would have been, I mean, the first thing they would have checked is whether the premiums were paid. And if that weren't the case, they would have denied the claim. It simply was never an issue until Reliance's attorney brought it up in the litigation. And Reliance would have never brought this up because they knew the premiums were paid. And the record actually showed that the premiums were paid. There were some claims.
Well, I mean, again, it's a little bit of a technical argument, I think, that they're now claiming, which is that you didn't prove it in the administrative proceeding. So maybe it was paid, but you didn't prove it. And that's why I was asking whether the payment by the insurance company of the short-term disability was circumstantial evidence of the premium payment.
Yes, I mean, that's their argument, but it's also, I don't think, a fair argument. I mean, he also didn't provide his birth certificate to prove that his name was Michael Miller. There was no reason to prove something that Reliance knows all along. And Reliance never denied the appeal. They never made a decision on the appeal. They just simply ignored it. And that's another factor here. Had he not paid his premiums, it would have been something, first of all, they wouldn't have approved two separate short-term disability plans. There wouldn't have been claims notes saying that the premiums were paid. But they also would have, when they did, got the appeal, they would have denied the appeal saying the premiums weren't paid. And then we could have done something about it. We could have said, okay, well, here's some evidence showing that the premiums are paid that you have in your possession, but we'll give it to you again. But it's simply just, it was just never an issue. And that's one of the reasons why in an ERISA case, they're not supposed to be allowed to make arguments that weren't made during the administrative process, because we could have demonstrated this during the administrative process. We wouldn't have had to have moved to supplement the record while we were doing the cross motions for summary judgment at that point. But
okay, I'm going to give you one extra minute and your opponent one extra minute if you want to cover the knee, neck, back.
Sure. If the pre-existing condition clause does apply, we believe that he's still entitled to benefits under the policy because he did not receive treatment for his right knee or for his back and neck pain during the look-back period. And if you go through the medical records, which we tried to summarize in the briefs and in at the district court level, you'll see that he didn't have treatment for those conditions. Now, Reliance argues that there was one medical record, I think from a physical therapist, that said that he was rehabbing the knees at one point at a time. It was actually not from the physical therapist. It was from the doctor he was seeing for his wrist pain. And he noted in that record that he was rehabbing his knees. And Reliance is saying that that equated to treatment for that condition or consultation for that treatment, which would trigger the look-back clause. But we believe it did not. And because he wasn't even treating with that doctor, and he wasn't rehabbing his knees. He was rehabbing his left knee at the time, but he not his right knee. So we believe his right knee is disabling independent of his other conditions. And we also believe his back and his neck pain. He's got significant stenosis in his spine.
Your time is up. You've reserved some time for rebuttal, and we'll now hear from opposing counsel.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Joshua Bachrach, represent Reliance Standard Life. I think it's important to look at the, because your honors have asked the questions about the coverage language in the policy, the active language. And I think it's important, under ERISA, you have to read language together. And this policy says you have to be an active full-time employee. And full-time is defined as working for your employer for a minimum of 30 hours per week during your regular work week. And counsel didn't address that language, during your regular work week.
Well, what was I agree. What was Mr. Miller's regular work week? Was it 30 hours?
Mr. Miller had no regular work week on or about September 1, 2015. Well, because he was already disabled.
But when he was at work, what was his regular work week?
Well, that I don't know that has been established, because counsel hasn't established that. There's some evidence he worked 2 weeks, then he'd be off 2 weeks. I don't know that, you know, so at what point is it that he did that regularly? Because that's the language, regular work week. So we know in July, as of July 1, 2015, he stops working, and he doesn't work again until 1 year later. So we have a whole year where there is no work at all, 0 hours for that entire span. So to say that he had a regular work week years ago, that doesn't qualify, because the policy looks to at the time of the transfer of coverage on September 1, 2015. Did he regularly work a minimum of 30 hours a week?
And okay, the answer to that is no. I don't understand why you have this second paragraph that says explicitly, but was not actively at work due to injury or sickness on the effective date of this policy and would otherwise qualify. I mean, why are we going to have that if we're requiring that his regular work week be going on right then?
I'll explain it, Your Honor. And it's important, I'm going to put in the context of comments that counsel made. So counsel said that this transfer of insurance coverage protects somebody if they are, quote, not working that day, end quote. And later he said that somebody may be off during a weekend or on a holiday, and this protects their coverage. And that is the purpose, because if a person is missing a day or two at the time of there's a transfer from one carrier to another, this protects them. So if it happens to be during a holiday and they're not working that day, they're going to be insured by Reliance. If they're out sick due to a cold or a flu, they're going to be insured by Reliance.
Okay, but what about if they had COVID and they were in the hospital for 3 months? Would that count?
If their hospitalization began 3 months earlier, and I don't think you have to say COVID, it could be anything. If their regular work week as of September 1, and you look, again, regular. So what does that mean? That means on a regular basis, on a consistent basis. That's what the dictionary, we provided the dictionary definitions of what regular means in our briefs. So on a regular basis, as of September 1, he had to regularly work 30 hours a week, and he didn't.
Yeah, but let's say on July 1, he got COVID and ended up in the hospital, and September 1, he's still there. But prior to that, he had worked 30 years, 60 hours a week. Let's just give that hypo. Why would he not be covered? Why would this not apply?
Because he's not regularly working as of September 1. I believe it's unreasonable to say that in the context of the words active, what active means, and regularly working, which is the definition of full-time, that a person who has not worked in approximately 3 months, and when you look in the aggregate, has not worked in a complete year, they are not regularly working the required number of hours.
But we don't look at the aggregate. We're looking at the effective date. And I guess I don't really understand the purpose of this second paragraph if it's not going to apply to someone who's been, I don't know, I don't remember. He said something like 20, 30 years at this company. He's been there a long, long time, working regularly. Then he gets sick and he's gone for a while. At that point, 3 months. Or 2 months, I get. Well, it was it November? I mean, so was it September or October? Remind me. He was, okay, yeah, July to, okay, 2 months. So 2 months he had been gone. Where is it in this policy that it differentiates between a week in the hospital for COVID, 2 weeks, a month, 2 months? Where does it differentiate that? Because we have all kinds of people that are in the hospital for several months, and then wonderfully they get out and they're back in the world. And then some of them pass away, sadly. But that's a real event right now. So why, I mean, how are we supposed to differentiate? Is it the 1 week COVID person, the 2 week, a month, 2 months?
Your Honor, I think you have to look at the language in the policy. The language in the policy is active, which means we cite to a 10th Circuit decision. It means actually working, performing your duties. But then you have to read in conjunction with the definition of full time, regularly doing that. So you must be regularly working at the transfer date. And this person was not, if he's not working if he's not working in 2 months. And I know Your Honor keeps mentioning COVID. It's regardless of the, you know, maybe that is an issue today in other cases, but that's not the issue here. And I think that just in some ways prejudices the issues in this case, because the transfer of insurance.
If we have to construe the policy, I mean, whatever we issue in this opinion is going to affect future opinions. And so if we were to rule that you could only be off for a weekend or only sick for 1 day, a flu for 1 day is good enough, but a COVID for a week is not, that is going to affect people. I'm not saying, I mean, we have to follow the law whether it hurts or helps people. That's not my point. But my point is it does matter what our construction is. And so I'm just trying to understand your argument, because this notion that you have to be regularly at work is to me inconsistent with the second paragraph that understands you might be injured or sick.
I don't believe it is inconsistent. What they're trying to do is to say if you are injured or sick for a day, for a few days, you're not going to lose your coverage. But Your Honor, there's
a... If you're writing our opinion, so you're writing the opinion, how many days do we put down?
I would look at the dictionary definition of regular, which is in my briefs, which is regular means on a consistent basis, on a scheduled basis. And when you look at that, this person was not scheduled or consistently working on September 1, 2015 with any regularity because he hadn't worked in 2 months. I don't think, and it's hard to put some temporal meaning except for regular, the definition of regular, which means consistent. And on a consistent basis, as of September 1, he was not regularly working 30 hours a week because he had not done so since June 26, I believe, the last day that he regularly worked. I don't think a person would say that, you know, I'm regularly working. And by the way, that's a word in the policy. It says full-time means working for your employer for a minimum of 30 hours per week during your regular work week. Not that you have worked in the past for 30 hours a week. And counsel mentioned the Jackson case, which is an unpublished decision. In that case, it involved very different language. That case had language that defined it as working as required by the employer. This now, policy so, doesn't.
I have two questions since you're talking about the case law. Yes, sir. Well, my first question is not related to the case law. What about the, are you still pursuing the premium issue that we discussed with your opponent? Number one, and secondly, with regard to the case law, how do you distinguish Wallace? Would you please take us through that?
Certainly, Your Honor. So as far as the premium issue goes, counsel is saying we waived the issue because we didn't address it, but again, it's his burden. And that was the point I was making. He said in his letter that I paid premiums, but he provided no proof. That's like saying I'm disabled, but you don't give a doctor's note. Judge Haynes, you said, but you should have the information. We don't, because this is group coverage. So the employer submits the premium on behalf of everybody, and that goes to a premium billing unit. And the claims department would have that information. They wouldn't. They would know if premiums were paid by the group, but unless somebody affirmatively states that premiums were paid by this individual, they would not necessarily have that.
Why would you recognize a short-term disability if he hadn't paid premiums?
It was a mistake, frankly.
Twice?
No, because the second claim, so there are two claims, October 23, 2015, and then the one from August of 2016. So let's look at the 2015 claim first. Short-term disability was paid. That was a mistake. The long-term disability was denied on that one for the very reason that there was no coverage. Reliance realized at the time that it shouldn't have approved the short-term disability because he was not covered as of September 1, the transfer date.
The mistake that it has to do with premiums though, right?
What does it have to do with premiums? Well, yeah. Counsel argued they paid the short-term, therefore they acknowledged there's coverage. That's not true because they denied the 2015 long-term disability claim. There's no waiver here. But what it has to do with premiums is what they look to is have premiums been paid by the employer? And then the employer is the one who says, yes, this person paid premiums or was paying premiums. So
but
we have to rely on what the employer
says.
Before you
pay any benefits under the insurance, before your client pays any benefits under the insurance, they are going to check that this person is one of the insured people, at least as far as premiums being paid. If they're not going to check it, then why should we, you know, years later enforce something you're not even enforcing?
Your Honor, they're not checking it, except they are checking it to see has the group paid the premiums. And then if they learn later on, it's an issue. And this is the point I was getting for Judge Engelhardt. It's not an issue. The premium issue part here, apparently there has been information submitted that he did pay it. That hasn't been our defense in our briefs and counsel saying I've misrepresented to the courts. I have not, and I'm offended by that. But the fact is we stated from the start that the information that was should have been provided wasn't, but that we've never contested it in subsequent briefs.
I understand, is it an issue that this panel needs to decide? In other words, is that a reason why the transfer provision does not apply?
No, Your Honor, you don't need to address it because
what?
He has to prove before, you can't just say premiums are paid, therefore transfer of insurance coverage.
Yeah, I get that.
The first thing you have to show is he's eligible. He's well, an sure, eligible
but,
class.
But, right. But so let's say hypothetically we say he's eligible. Is the non-payment of premiums then something we have to decide?
No.
Why not?
No, Your Honor. Because based on information that I will add was improperly obtained by counsel, counsel contacted my client directly during the litigation, which I have a lot of problems with that conduct, but that information shows that premiums were accepted by Reliance from his client.
Okay, so, look, I mean, I don't want to get into, all I'm asking about, I'm not asking about litigation conduct. I'm asking about, for purposes of this appeal, do you concede that premiums paid is not a reason for saying that the transfer provision does not apply?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. I agree. And we've said that. I believe I said
you
it.
You need
in
to
the
address the Wallace question.
Yeah.
That
get to Wallace.
Yeah.
Yes. So that's a good point. So in the Wallace case, what the Sixth Circuit said in that case was that there were no findings by the district court on whether the employer had established regular full-time hours, whether there were regular full-time mm-hmm. hours for this person. And since there was no fact-finding on the issue of regular full-time, that issue was remanded back from the appellate court. But in this case, and one of, I apologize, I don't recall who, one of your honors had asked whether there was a decision on that issue in this case. And there was, there were specific fact findings and we cite to them towards the end of our brief, but there were specific fact findings by the district court in this case on why he wasn't in fact an eligible person. Part of that being that he was not an active full-time employee regularly working 30 hours a week. And the court mentioned the fact that he had not worked since late June of 2015. The court mentioned the fact that he was out of work due to the disability and did not work again for quite a period of time.
Hey, so let me ask you this though. Why would the language then be, it was not actively at work due to injury or sickness on the effective date and would otherwise qualify? So if he was not sick or injured, he would otherwise qualify. If he was not sitting in the hospital, if he was not sitting at home injured, he would otherwise qualify. Why doesn't that take us back to the moment before the injury or sickness?
Your Honor, that goes back to the point, and maybe I'm not saying it as well as I can, and I hope I do better now. So if he was injured or sick the day before, you know, August 31st of 2015, if he is sick on that date or it's a holiday, and so on the next day, the coverage comes into effect and he's not at work that day, he's not going to lose coverage. But it was never intended to have somebody who hasn't worked in 2 months. So what happens if he's still paying premiums, Your Honor, and he hasn't worked in 2 years? Is he still regularly working?
I mean, y'all write the policy. You can certainly say otherwise qualify for this many months, this many days, whatever. But to me, otherwise qualify means if he weren't injured or sick, he would have been an eligible person, yada, yada, yada. And so that seems to me that you don't count the time he's injured or sick. And you look before that. And before that, he started in 1989 and has been working there for 26 years or something like that. I'm not very good at math, but something like 26 years. So that would seem like he otherwise would qualify had he not been injured or sick. Otherwise qualify, yeah. So that strikes me as if you all wanted to be specific that the injury or sickness had to be only a week or something like that, you absolutely could put that in there. And I respect that. I very much respect the right of insurance companies within the law, obviously, to write policies how they want to. But that otherwise qualified to me makes no sense if we're going to say the day he was injured or sick, he still has to be working full time and regularly and all that, but we won't count that one day. We only count the day before, whatever, because I just don't see that in here.
Your Honor, you're saying you have to look at before, and before for 2 months, he hadn't worked at all. So he was not regularly working a minimum of 30 hours a week. But I think you also have to look in the context, and I'm trying to find the exact language in the policy on where the otherwise comes. And you have to, it says that a person still, they still have to be in an eligible class.
And where's the word still?
No, I'm adding the word still, okay. But it's but the language is there that they have to be in an eligible class.
Okay, I get that, but what I'm trying to understand is, but was not actively at work due to injury or sickness on the effective date and would otherwise qualify. What does the word otherwise refer to here?
Let me just look at it briefly, Your Honor, so I can answer that. So what they're, I believe this goes back to what I was saying. So if they are out due to injury or sickness on the day this policy is to go into effect, and that's what it's talking about, on the day prior to this policy's effective date, right? If they're not there, their coverage under some interpretations might have ended. They may not have transferred here. But what this policy is saying though, but if you are in an eligible, if you're an eligible person, you will still remain coverage as long as these three other parts are covered. You satisfy them as well. And what are those three other, you know, those three other parts include the payment of the premium, had been insured by the prior carrier. You know, that's all fine. You see, part of what's going on here, which is kind of interesting, is if he was already disabled, and we know he was from Prudential, why is he even paying premiums? Most people wouldn't be paying premiums, but he is here. So then you have to look at, but is he still eligible? Because the payment of premiums alone doesn't guarantee coverage. He has to be an eligible person. It says would otherwise qualify as an eligible person.
I think
what you're doing is you're saying,
counsel, I think we all agree that where we need to look then is whether he is an active full-time employee under the eligible class provision. And we've talked a lot about what full-time means. We haven't so much talked about what active means, but I guess going back to Judge Englehart's question, we have a Sixth Circuit opinion that I think is addressing an identical policy language. And it says these two terms, active and full-time employee, are ambiguous. And so therefore there are multiple ways they could be interpreted, but we need to interpret them in favor of the insured. Now, do you say that the Sixth Circuit was incorrect in that decision so that I guess effectively we create a circuit split if we disagree?
Well, there's already been a circuit split on the issue of what active means with the 10th Circuit, and actually the Sixth Circuit in another case said active means actually working, a case called Turner versus Safeco. So they've created their own little split within their circuit. And on other issues, this court has disagreed with the Sixth Circuit, whereas this court has said that the term occupation, regular occupation, is unambiguous under de novo review, and the Sixth Circuit has held otherwise, the Second Circuit. So there's already splits. And I think in this case, what you have to do is look at what's reasonable. And is it reasonable to conclude that a person who's not active or actually at work, if I may finish, Your Honor, is not actively at work or actually at work, has not been for 2 months and is not again for a year, can they be considered actually working regularly on a full-time basis? And I think the answer to that is no.
Okay, and I want to be fair to you because we took all the time with the question number one. I want to make sure you have, I'll give you another minute to cover the knee, neck, back argument.
Thank you, Your Honor, I appreciate that. So with the right knee, we know that in 2016, he had both right and left knee replacement, total knee replacement. In June, during the look back period where he had to be treatment free, he's telling a doctor that he has worse pain, especially with rehabbing the knees. So at the very least, he's consulting with a medical specialist for the knee. But that's not the only one. Counsel said that's the only record. It's not. We cite to its ROA 1001 and 1005, where he's telling his physical therapist that his knees are stiff. So he's complaining and consulting about his knees. As to the neck and back, on page 16 of counsel's reply brief, he cites to 10 records. 9 of them are from 2015. They don't prove a disability in 2016. The other one, the only other one says there's a history of low back pain and neck pain. History doesn't mean a present issue. So I thank you for your additional time, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We appreciate your argument. And Pam, if you would give Mr. Toledano 6 minutes. So, okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. So a couple things here. I wanted to touch on this regular work week requirement in the policy. Full-time is defined as working for a minimum of 30 hours during a person's regular work week. That's true. And what that means is when you're healthy enough to work, you are working a minimum of 30 hours a week. And Michael Miller was working at least 30 hours a week when he was working.
But how do you respond to Mr. Buckrock's concern about, you know, somebody who, let's say, is in the hospital for years or home with an injury for years, and now all of a sudden wants to claim that they are a transferred insured? I mean, is there some sort of time cutoff, and how do we deal with that?
There isn't, as the way the policy is written. I think we have to look at the policy language, and if they wanted to cut it off at some certain time limitation, they could have done so, but they didn't. So I don't know how we can just make one up at this point.
Now, there's this issue of the full-time and all of that. Has there ever been any argument that the fact that for 2 weeks he's sort of 24 hours a day on and 2 weeks he's off, has anybody argued that that's not full time?
No, Your Honor.
And that's just the way that's set up for everybody? I mean, so nobody would be full time, at least no pilot would be full time?
Pilots, they all work the same. And we, if you look at a record, the administrative record at 882, a record on appeal 882 and 885, those two bait stamps, there's an explanation of how pilots work. And it's 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and they're working 24 hours a day when they are working. And we also provided a list of days that he was working, so you can see a schedule. And he was working at least 30 hours a week. So he was working full time. And so I don't think that's an issue in this case.
You're saying averaging out the month, it'd be 30 hours a week.
That's right. And this court looks at this case from a de novo perspective, applying the same standards as the district court. So the court can look at these record documents and find that he was a full-time employee. I don't see a need to remand this matter.
Well, then why didn't the Sixth Circuit decide it if this is just something we can all just look at the record and make a decision?
Yeah, I don't think the evidence was in that particular file. I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with the record and what was actually in there. But that's what they decided to do in that case, though. Judge Guidry did not address this issue. I mean, he never addressed the issue of whether Miller was working for a minimum of 30 hours during his regular work week. And it was just not the issue that he was focused on in this case. And so this was never decided by the district court.
Well, why even have the phrase eligible person if we're not going to look at the guy's situation that day or around that day? That's really Mr. Buckrock's bottom line argument, as I understand it, is we're looking at the relevant day, and he hadn't been to work for 2 months at that relevant day, so how's he an eligible person? That's his argument. What's your response?
Right. I mean, he's trying to read an actively at work requirement into the policy that's just not there. If that's what they wanted, they needed to say that he needed to be actively at work on the day that Reliance began insuring the plan, but the policy simply does not say that. And the Sixth Circuit recognized that in Wallace, that this court recognized it in Jackson, albeit unpublished. Insureds get the benefit of the doubt when there's an ambiguity in the policy.
I guess the hard part for me is it's pretty clear what is trying to be happen here. The employer is trying to switch insurance companies without messing up its employees. And that, I guess, is not always perfectly done. But to me, if you back up, transfer of insurance coverage is the title. That's what is happening. You've got an employer who decides that Prudential is too expensive or not working out or whatever, gets a better deal with Reliance, wants to move everything over. but wants to kind of keep everybody in the same cubby they were in.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what this is for. And they were very well aware of the issues. That they actually met with one of the Reliance representatives and discussed Michael Miller's specific situation because they didn't want anything to happen to his insurance coverage in the event he came back to work and there was a change of who's going to be responsible for this. And they said everything was going to be fine. And they were really blindsided when the claim was denied based on this pre-existing condition because he thought he had the credit for that, which he should have. So, you know, we...
Is it appropriate for us to consider that title, transfer of insurance coverage, or should we only consider the other words that we've been talking about, the otherwise, the eligible person, regular, active, full-time?
I think you can consider the transfer of insurance coverage. I mean, that's what this was designed to do. All these group disability insurance policies that I've seen have this. They give people credit for the time incurred towards the pre-existing condition limitation credit. And that's what this policy was designed to do. It's a little bit cumbersome, the wording of it, and it's created some issues as we've seen in the Sixth Circuit and now here at Fifth Circuit. But I see no reason to create a circuit split. I mean, this is literally the exact same facts and the exact same policy language.
What about the Tenth Circuit though? Your opponents said we already have a circuit split.
It's not exactly the same factual circumstances. I don't believe that was briefed in Reliance's appellee brief. I think he's talking about the Turner case, but I don't remember the specific facts of that, but I know there were some factual differences and there were differences in the way that policy was worded.
Okay. But, well, your time is up. We'll take a good hard look again at it. We really appreciate both sides' arguments. Very, very well done. Appreciate that very much. The case is now under submission and we will excuse you from the argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.